From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
You said that you wanted to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, but you were waiting for the Supreme Court decision that came out today. Do you intend now to close the Guantanamo Bay quickly? And how do you deal with the suspects that you said were too dangerous to be released or sent home?
Yeah, I thank you for the question on the court ruling that literally came out in the midst of my meeting with the Prime Minister. And so I haven't had a chance to fully review the findings of the Supreme Court. I want to assure you that we take them very seriously.
In a rebuke to the Bush administration, the Supreme Court rules against the use of military tribunals to try Guantanamo prisoners. We'll speak with attorney Barbara Olshansky of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represents over 250 detainees at Guantanamo. Then Dr. Stephen Miles on oath betrayed, torture, medical complicity, and the war on terror.
Physicians, nurses, and medics were complicit with the human rights abuses in American prisons throughout Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo. This is the finding from Freedom of Information documents released by the ACLU.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In a landmark decision, the Supreme Court has rebuked the Bush administration for forming military tribunals to try prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. In a 5-3 ruling, the court said the military tribunals violate both the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Geneva Convention. The impact of the case is expected to go well beyond Guantanamo, as the justices ruled that the so-called war on terror must be fought under international rules. Legal experts say the ruling challenges the Bush administration's legal defense of harsh interrogation methods, the CIA's secret prisons, and the National Security Agency's domestic surveillance program. The court ruled the Geneva Convention must apply to prisoners captured in the war on terror. In Thursday's ruling, Justice John Paul Stevens wrote, quote, "The executive is bound to comply with the rule of law that prevails in this jurisdiction." The New York Times called the decision a, quote, "historic event, a defining moment in the ever-shifting balance of power." Ben Wisner of the American Civil Liberties Union hailed the Supreme Court's ruling.
It's a very important decision today, and we have to remember what Guantanamo is. Guantanamo was an attempt on behalf of the administration to create an island outside the law, to bring these detainees to a place where no law applied to them and where the United States could do whatever it wanted to them. And what the Supreme Court said today is that even in Guantanamo Bay, U.S. law and international law apply. And if we're going to try these people for crimes, we have to try them under a legal system, not a system that we make up as we go along.
Voting in favor of the military tribunals were three justices, Antonin Scalia, Samuel Alito, and Clarence Thomas. For the first time in his 15 years on the court, Clarence Thomas read part of his dissent from the bench. He said the court's decision would, quote, "sorely hamper the president's ability to confront and defeat a new and deadly enemy." Chief Justice John Roberts abstained from the case because he'd ruled on the case in favor of the military tribunals when he served as a federal judge. Unknown at the time of that ruling was that Roberts was already being interviewed by the White House for a seat on the Supreme Court. Human rights groups around the world hailed Thursday's Supreme Court ruling. This is British attorney Clive Stafford Smith, who represents a number of prisoners at Guantanamo.
I think the message for the Bush administration is very clear, that if you are fighting a war for democracy and the rule of law, the first casualty shouldn't be the rule of law. We should live up to our principles. And you know, if you do, if you respect human rights, then not only do more people respect you and want to help you, there are far fewer people who want to blow you up. It's just good policy as well as being decent.
We'll have more on the ruling in a few minutes. Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip has entered its third day as Israel attempts to recover a captured soldier. Overnight, Israeli warplanes bombed Gaza more than 30 times. One Israeli bomb hit the Palestinian Interior Ministry office in Gaza City and set it ablaze. Israeli shells also hit the electricity distribution network in northern Gaza. This comes just 2 days after Israeli warplanes bombed Gaza's main power station, leaving much of Gaza without power. The United Nations is warning Gaza is 3 days away from a deadly humanitarian crisis unless Israel promptly restores fuel and electricity. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Israel has not allowed fuel to flow into Gaza for 4 days. Many Gaza residents are now without clean water because they rely on electricity to pump that water. The UN's emergency relief coordinator, Yang Eglin, said military action targeting innocent civilians violates international humanitarian law. Israel's also coming under increasing criticism for its decision to seize at least 64 Hamas lawmakers, including the Palestinian foreign minister. One-third of the Palestinian cabinet is now being detained by Israel. This is UN envoy Alvaro de Soto.
I'm not sure what purpose is served by these arrests. I don't understand how it fits into the purpose of an operation which, as I understood, was designed in order to obtain the release of Gilad Shalit.
But Israel has defended the move. This is Public Security Minister Avi Dichter.
We'll put in jail every person belonging to Hamas that we suspect that he has something to do with Hamas' philosophy of carrying out terror attacks, which means assassinating, murdering Israelis, never mind if it's civilians or soldiers, never mind if it's within green lines or within the West Bank or the Gaza Strip and from those areas towards Israel.
Earlier today, Israel revoked the Jerusalem residency rights of 4 Hamas officials. In Iraq, a top Iraqi Sunni leader with ties to leading insurgent groups says rebels have rejected Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's national reconciliation plan. They rejected it because it fails to offer a timetable for the withdrawal of foreign troops. Romania has become the latest country to announce it's planning to withdraw its troops from Iraq. In a surprise move, Romania's prime minister ordered the removal of all of its 890 troops. He cited the human and financial cost of the war. 10 days ago, Japan announced plans to pull its 600 troops out of Iraq within weeks. Italy's already said it'll remove its troops by year's end. Spain, the Netherlands, Ukraine, Nicaragua, the Philippines, and Honduras have already pulled out. Meanwhile, a new poll of 100 leading counterterrorism and national security experts has found that 84% believe the U.S. is not winning the war on terror. And 87% of the experts said the war in Iraq is hurting the global anti-terror campaign. The poll was conducted by the magazine Foreign Policy and the Center for American Progress. One former CIA official who described himself as a conservative Republican said the war in Iraq has provided global terrorist groups with a recruiting bonanza and a valuable training ground. In Washington, D.C., President Bush and the Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi warned North Korea not to test fire a long-range ballistic missile. President Bush met with Koizumi at the White House Thursday.
The North Korean issue is one, obviously, that's got everybody's attention now. Discussed this issue in length. We both agreed that it's very important to remain united in sending a clear message to the North Korean leader that, first of all, launching the missile is unacceptable.
Today, President Bush and the Japanese Prime Minister are heading to Elvis Presley's home at Graceland. International pressure has been mounting on North Korea ever since the New York Times reported on its front page 2 weeks ago that North Korea's long-range missiles were fueled and ready to take off. The report was based on unnamed officials. But now the Times appears to be backing off from its original reporting. Earlier this week, the paper ran an article on page A9 quoting an unnamed official admitting it's actually impossible to even know if North Korea has fueled the missile since the missile is inside a closed container. On Capitol Hill, the Republican-led House of Representatives has passed a resolution condemning news organizations for reporting on classified information that the government wants to keep secret. The vote came less than a week after the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal revealed the U.S. Treasury Department is secretly monitoring international bank transactions. The resolution's co-sponsor, Ohio Republican Mike Oxley, said the government, quote, expects the cooperation of all news media as it fights the so-called war on terror. Democrat Maurice Hinchey of New York accused his Republican counterparts of trying to intimidate the press. Meanwhile, House Republican J.D. Hayworth of Arizona has collected the signatures of 70 House members to call for the media credentials of the New York Times to be revoked. The UN Human Rights Council has approved a new international treaty to ban states from abducting individuals and hiding them in secret prisons or killing them. The treaty, which still has to be approved by the UN General Assembly, would require nations to keep registers of prisoners and tell their families the truth about their disappearance. The United States is not expected to ratify the pact, the International Convention for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearance. And a coalition of advocacy groups are suing the federal government in an effort to challenge a new law that requires all Medicaid recipients to prove their citizenship or lose their benefits or long-term care. The rule goes into effect tomorrow. Critics fear millions of U.S. citizens may not be able to produce the necessary paperwork. Most affected might be elderly African Americans who were born in the rural South at a time when many black women were barred from maternity wards. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners and viewers. In a major defeat for the Bush administration, the Supreme Court has ruled against the use of military commissions to try Guantanamo detainees. The White House established the commissions in the months after 9/11 for detainees captured in the so-called War on Terror. The commissions placed several restrictions on the rights of suspects, including limited access to the evidence used against them. In a 5-3 vote Thursday, the court ruled the practice violates U.S. and international law. Chief Justice John Roberts recused himself from the case. He had previously taken part in a federal appeals court decision that had rejected a challenge to the legality of the commissions.
The ruling came in the case of Salim Ahmed Hamdan, a Yemeni citizen accused of being an active member of al-Qaeda. Hamdan has been seeking the military to either dismiss his case or try him in a normal military tribunal or federal court. This is former Guantanamo prisoner Mozan Beg.
I was held next to Salim Hamdan in Guantanamo for a period of 2 months, and he often had working together with Charles Swift in trying to obtain his rights. But we all remained skeptical because we felt that it was the United States government, in one sense, trying to feel good about itself in offering these types of laws and telling the detainees that at least you have the ability to defend yourself in this way, which wasn't true at all.
The Supreme Court ruling was hailed by human rights groups, legal experts, and other former prisoners. In a statement, the freed British detainee Shafiq Rasool, who spent 2 years at Guantanamo without charge, said, quote, "This is another step in our collective efforts to see that those we left behind are treated fairly under international law." President Bush took questions from reporters shortly after the verdict was announced. He was at the White House in a joint news appearance with the Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi.
You've said that you wanted to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, but you were waiting for the Supreme Court decision that came out today. Do you intend now to close the Guantanamo Bay quickly? And how do you deal with the suspects that you said were too dangerous to be released or sent home?
Yeah, I thank you for the question on the court ruling that literally came out in the midst of my meeting with the Prime Minister. And so I haven't had a chance to fully review the findings of the Supreme Court. I want to assure you that we take them very seriously. Two, that to the extent that there is latitude to work with the Congress to determine whether or not the military tribunals will be an avenue in which to give people their day in court, we will do so. The American people need to know that this ruling, as I understand it, won't cause killers to be put out on the street. In other words, there's not a as I was a drive-by briefing on the way here, I was told that this was not going to be the case. At any rate, we will seriously look at the findings, obviously. And one thing I'm not going to do, though, is I'm not going to jeopardize the safety of the American people. People got to understand that. I understand we're in a war on terror, that these people were picked up off of a battlefield. And I will protect the people and at the same time conform with the findings of the Supreme Court. And so, well, I haven't had a chance to fully review what the court said, Terry. I wish I had. If I could have given you a better answer, as I say, we take the findings seriously. And again, as I understand it now, please don't hold me to this. That there is a way forward with military tribunals in working with the United States Congress. As I understand, certain senators have already been out expressing their desire to address what the Supreme Court found, and we will work with the Congress. I want to find a way forward. In other words, I have told the people that I would like for there to be a way to return people from Guantanamo to their home countries, but some of them, people need to be tried in our courts. And that's the Hamden decision was the way forward for that part of my statement. And again, I would like to review the case. And we are. We got people looking at it right now to determine how we can work with Congress, if that's available, to solve the problem.
President Bush speaking Thursday at the White House. He was asked a follow-up question later in his news conference.
Yes, Mr. President, we can assume you've been at least been given some of the broad strokes of the Supreme Court's decision on Guantanamo.
Well, I just gave you the answer on that. I'd be glad to answer another question. Well, actually, I gave you the broad strokes I've been given.
Right, but this, can you comment on what looks like a judicial repudiation of your administration's policy on the treatment of terror suspects post 9/11?
Matt, I can't. I wish I could comment on Wood. Obviously, I'm a person who generally comments on things. I haven't been briefed enough to make a comment on it, except for the following things. I'm sorry you had to waste your question, but we will conform to the Supreme Court. We will analyze the decision. To the extent that the Congress is given any latitude to develop a way forward using military tribunals, we will work with them. As I understand, a senator has already been on TV. I haven't seen it, hadn't heard what he said, but as they briefed me and said he wants to devise law in conformity with the case that would enable us to use a military tribunal to hold these people to account. And if that's the case, we'll work with him. But, that's I can't comment any more than I have just done in the first question. Otherwise, I would have. I just hadn't been fully briefed enough to answer your question, Matt.
Barbara Olshansky joins us in our Firehouse studio. She's attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. The center filed two briefs in this case and has represented a number of Guantanamo prisoners, over 250. She's the author of The Case for Impeachment. Her forthcoming book out next month is called Democracy Detained, Secret Unconstitutional Practices in the U.S. War on Terror. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Barbara.
Thank you for having me.
First, your response to this landmark ruling of the Supreme Court.
For us, I think it was a tremendous reaffirmation that of the institutions and how they can work in the country. The fact that the judiciary was willing to step up to the plate and look at what the executive is doing and do the right thing, take the action to make sure that the executive complies with the law. And for me, although it sounds so basic, it's something that we were watching erode over the last 5 years. And so that was probably the most heartening part of it, and that they were willing to look at it in its entire scope. And what this decision says in very sort of calm, rational, historical terms is that the entire structure of the war on terror is unlawful, that it was based on a premise, an idea of an enemy combatant, which is a status that was created by the president, that it was intended to take place on an island that was outside the law somehow, and that the president could create all of the laws that applied there, like it was his own constructed universe. And what this decision does in a very rational way is say, You can't do that. No piece of what you have done is lawful. And it's quite an astounding decision for that reason. It really goes to, as you said, every part of the war on terror.
But at the same time, it does appear that Congress is poised possibly to make some of the various things that the Supreme Court declared unlawful lawful. And certainly in December when it passed, when it eliminated habeas corpus for detainees at Guantanamo, it signaled that it was ready to do so. And now, as the president said, our inspector is already ready, a bill to fix some of the problems that the Supreme Court saw in the president's actions.
Yeah, that's true. We had about 5 minutes of elation before we heard about the proposed legislation, and that is true. I think Congress is going to be very cautious. I know that Senator Spector has said that he's going to convene hearings of the Judiciary Committee, which didn't happen last time. It gives us an opportunity to have a role and to make clear what the ramifications are of everything that would happen. And also, this decision makes clear that anything that comes out of this is bound by the Geneva Conventions. And for us at the Center for Constitutional Rights, that has been our rallying cry from the beginning, is that the law applies and that the Geneva Conventions, we signed and ratified them. We helped make them in 1949, and they apply wherever we act. There's no corner of the globe where people are unprotected. And that's what this court says. The next time you try and do something, you better look at these. You better look at the four Geneva Conventions. You better look at Common Article 3. You can't create something out of whole cloth.
But let's talk about who this applies to. You're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court saying the military tribunals are unconstitutional or a violation of Geneva Conventions, but that's, what, 10 people?
That is 10 people that are designated.
Prisoners.
Right.
There are hundreds of prisoners at Guantanamo.
That's true. And the decision actually applies to everyone, because what the court is saying is not just that this commission was improperly, constructed, but that the conventions apply to the war on terror. Because whether or not we are in an international armed conflict with another recognized country, or the way the Bush administration wants to see it is, it's sort of a war when it comes to his commander-in-chief powers, but not a war when he has to comply with the laws of war. What the court says here is, if you're going to call it a war, you have to comply with the Geneva Conventions for everyone. And that really is the tenor of this decision, and it affects everyone in Guantanamo. Also because, the Detainee Treatment Act, that effort in the end of last year to strip everyone of the right to go to court to challenge their detention, the court said, that didn't work. You can't do that retroactively. The statute doesn't say that. The congressional history doesn't look like that. We're not even going to get into the issue that you want to strip the writ of habeas corpus from people, something that we've had for, over 800 years. We're going to just tell you this is not what Congress did, and you can't do that. And so that means that all of those Geneva Convention rights that we alleged in the habeas petitions, all of the domestic rights that we're still asserting, they're still in play. And all of those people in Guantanamo, they have the right to their habeas hearing now.
I'd like to get back to this issue of the Geneva Conventions, because it seems to me that increasingly this is a huge debate in American society about how international law affects U.S. law, and the Bush administration has been pretty vocal in not recognizing international law. In essence, is the court possibly setting up a possible future conflict between a congressional law that is passed that then it goes in violation of the Geneva Conventions?
Well, that's a really good question. I think, there is a body of law that talks about that, about repudiation of international law. And I think that, down the road somewhere, I don't know that it's going to be in this case, that might happen depending on who we have in Congress. I think that issue of the recognition of international law in this country is a gigantic one. I think, we know that our law says that the treaties we sign become our federal law, right? That is part of our Constitution. It says it in the Constitution. If we sign and ratify the Geneva Conventions, then they are as if they are a federal statute. They provide those rights. And that's what this court said. And this court also said that it undid something that the lower court did. It said that those rights in the Geneva Convention that are individual-based, like your right to, not to be interrogated brutally or to be housed decently, to have food and water, they're individually enforceable in a court. And so this court and the Rasul court 2 years ago we're saying these are our laws, and you know the entire Hamdi decision is based on international law. And so what this court is saying is, you know what, we can't repudiate these types of agreements. We just can't. And in that way, thank goodness, the court is in concert with what the rest of the world is thinking.
We're talking to Barbara Olshansky. She is the attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights, the organization that's been representing hundreds of people at Guantanamo. Her forthcoming book is called Democracy Detained. We're going to go to break right now. But before we do, again, how Bush opened to reporters' questions at yesterday's news conference.
Walking in, I reminded the Prime Minister of one of Elvis's greatest songs, Don't Be Cruel. So keep that in mind, Hunt, when you ask your question.
We'll be back in a minute.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love. Baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't stop thinking of me. Don't make me feel this way. Come on over here and love me. You know what I want you to say. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Why should we be apart? I really love you, baby. Cross my heart. Let's walk up to the preacher and let's say I do. Then you'll know you'll have me, and I know that I'll have you. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love. Oh, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't be cruel.
Elvis Presley, Don't Be Cruel. Cited by President Bush yesterday in his news conference before he headed today with the Japanese Prime Minister to Elvis's home at Graceland. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
While the issue of military tribunals and the legal status of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay remains in the media spotlight, another aspect of the U.S. prison camp is largely being left out of the discussion in the corporate media: the abuse of prisoners at Guantanamo and the active participation of doctors in torture.
After 9/11, the Pentagon began using so-called behavioral science consultants, or BISCIT teams, to help interrogators obtain information from prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere. These medical teams reportedly advised the military on how to break prisoners to make them more cooperative. We're joined now by Dr. Stephen Miles, professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a faculty member of its Center for Bioethics. He's author of a new book that examines the role of doctors in torture. It's called Oath Betrayed: Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you so much.
Do you take heart from the ruling of the Supreme Court yesterday?
The Supreme Court ruling is a great ruling because Common Article 3, which is what the Supreme Court specifically referred to, not only provides for fair trials, but also is the section that addresses torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. So that the Supreme Court specifically said that that portion of international law is binding on all prison sites in the war on terror. I think it also lays a foundation for saying that the United States is knowingly culpable for its ongoing violations of these and past violations, because the Supreme Court didn't say it applied starting now. It says it applied from the very beginning. These are war crimes.
Well, Well, your book, Oath Betrayed, goes beyond that to look at specifically the role of medical professionals in this war on terror. And there's obviously a raging debate now in medical circles over to what degree doctors, nurses, and medics are being complicit in torture. And but you've now compiled together a lot of the existing record, right, of these cases.
Right. The ACLU put a FOIA suit, a Freedom of Information Act suit, out and pulled down 35,000 records, which actually give a very good picture of the medical system in the war on terror. And that medical system looks very much like, for example, the way physicians were complicit in torture in Argentina or Paraguay or Chile. Basically, they hid torture. They delayed the release or concealed death certificates pertaining to deaths by torture. They helped design and monitor harsh interrogations, and they neglected basic medical needs as they failed to record injuries from torture and failed to report that torture up the chain of command or to places that could stop it.
Can you talk about Abu Ghraib for a minute before we go back to Guantanamo, to talk about the role of doctors, to talk about the role of medics, of nurses? In the most famous cases, when people hear about them, I think they think about soldiers abusing. What about the role?
Well, one of the most famous pictures from Abu Ghraib, of course, is the body of Mohamed al-Jamadi wrapped in ice. He was arrested at his home and put up a fight. He was then bound. He was flipped into a Humvee. He was kicked and beaten and hit with a rifle butt while he was transported to Camp Jenny Ponzi just outside of Baghdad. There, a medic was in the room as he was saying, "I can't breathe. I feel like I'm going to die." He was interrogated briefly at Camp Jenny Ponzi. At that point, he was taken to Abu Ghraib. He was admitted to Abu Ghraib in the early hours of the morning. He was admitted as a CIA ghost prisoner. Now, what this meant was that he was not given the customary medical enrollment. In fact, he wasn't registered in the prison at all. He was naked. He was cold. He was complaining of shortness of breath. His head was in a sandbag, and then he was tied to his wrists were tied together behind his back and then lifted up and tied to a window bar behind him so that if he sank down, that his shoulders would be wrenched. And in fact, about an hour later, he did sink down. Now, keep in mind the man was in a sandbag over his head, and he was found to have died. Now, at that point, the Army did a autopsy, but the autopsy was concealed, as was the death certificate. It did find that he died of torture. And in fact, the first time we learned of this case was about 6 months after it happened. By concealing this, what the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology and the Defense Department did was they delayed public knowledge of a profound problem inside the prisons and essentially disabled an early warning system about torture.
Sticking on Abu Ghraib for a second, if there is one scandal that really changed massively Iraqi public opinion toward the occupation and the American presence, it was Abu Ghraib. But your story also documents how some of the same unit, that was involved in some of the abuses, there were signs previous to that of abuses of prisoners that were not dealt with by the military, and that, in essence, creating sort of the policy go-ahead for the kinds of tortures that Lynn later developed at Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, one of my favorites was Schlesinger was assigned by the Defense Department. He was a former Secretary of Defense to go investigate human rights abuses there. And he said, well, of course, America only tortures in the ticking time bomb scenario. And so he said, here's a great case. And he talks about this lieutenant colonel who, after a prisoner was beaten, then in order to get information about an attack on his unit, stuffed his head in a barrel and then discharged his gun next to the guy's head. Well, this guy was actually working with us and was betrayed, as many of the prisoners were, on a tip by jealous other players. In fact,
The prisoner was working with the U.S.
Yeah,
forces.
He was not a prisoner. He was actually a U.S. employee, and somebody else said that he was getting ready to attack our unit. And in fact, around 85% of the prisoners in Iraq and 60% in Guantanamo are innocent of any insurgency or al-Qaeda activity by the military intelligence's own estimate. In this case, we picked up one of our own employees. So Schlesinger said, well, the guy blurted out a bunch of names after they fired a gun next to his head. And Schlesinger said, this is a great example of a ticking time bomb case. But the problem was...
And the ticking time bomb case is what?
Well, you torture a person, and then you get immediate information to protect your unit, okay?
Because there might be a ticking time bomb.
Right. And in this case, they said that this guy knew about an impending attack on this unit, okay? But the guy gave out names of people who were innocent just because he was scared. We alienated him as an informant, and none of these names panned out. But here's the follow-up to the story. What they did then was they let this lieutenant colonel off very lightly, and they allowed him discharge with a pension, okay? And about 100 congressmen gave him dinners across the United States.
This is the man who put this prisoner's head in a barrel, put a gun next to his head in the barrel, and shot it off, the prisoner thinking his head was going to be blown off.
Exactly. After torturing him for about an hour. And then what happened was, when they let him off, they had these other soldiers who were beating up prisoners on the mistaken belief that these prisoners were involved in the rape of Jessica Lynch. Jessica Lynch, I don't believe, was raped, but these guys had nothing to do with it, even if she was. They were miles away from this. And what happened was they tied these guys down on the ground, or held them down on the ground, while the soldiers kicked them between their legs. Well, since they just let this lieutenant colonel off for shooting a gun next to this other guy's head, they decided to let these soldiers off with very minor sanctions, despite the recommendations of the commanders in the field. And then what happened was that this same unit was the unit that was sent over to Abu Ghraib and essentially had been given a green light for abuse of prisoners. So that instead of a ticking time bomb being prevented by torture, in the case of Schlesinger's anecdote, what really happened was a green light was given for abuses of prisoners.
We're talking to Stephen Miles, professor of medicine at University of Minnesota, a faculty member of its Center for Bioethics, and a practicing physician. His book is called Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror. Can you talk about another horrifying but famous image of an Iraqi prisoner, and that was the dead prisoner on ICE?
Yeah, that was the Monad el-Jamadi case that I just spoke about.
What about the man originally who you begin the case with? And that is something that Charles Grainer, who became famous and is now in prison,
right,
had to do with.
Yeah, this guy... I think his name was Al-Sheikh. What he did was a guard, an Iraqi trustee working in Abu Ghraib, smuggled in a pistol. The U.S. military found out about this. This is a legitimate security threat in the prison. And they wound up taking him down violently, which was appropriate because he drew the gun on the guards in the cell block. But he was injured in the course of this and went to a hospital. And he had a dislocated shoulder, and he had a very badly injured leg. When he came back to the cell block, Grainer was suspending him by his dislocated shoulder. And a medic and a doctor saw that the shoulder was dislocated, and saw that he was being suspended on two occasions and asked the guards not to do it, but fundamentally did not report the abuse and did not intervene to prevent this from happening. The guy obviously couldn't take the weight off of his shoulder because of his injured leg. Now, this guy also had a surgical drain in place from the operation, And a nurse in the middle of the night saw that this drain was in place and went to the dock and said they shouldn't have left this drain, open drain in place. It should be either taken out or it should be properly capped so an infection can't go back up the drain. And the doc said, well, that's the problem over in the MASH unit. They should take care of that in the hospital. That's not my problem. And the nurse warned the doc about his Geneva obligations, and he said, well, you do what you're going to do. I'm going to bed.
So this was Sergeant Teresa Adams, who was the nurse, and a right. Dr. Ackerman that you write about was the doctor. Is that right?
I don't recall the name of the doc.
All right.
Let me ask you, in within the medical profession, aside from the existing international conventions that exist around torture, what you also delve into what are their particular ethical imperatives that that have been adopted by various medical societies over the years, guiding doctors and nurses in their work?
Yeah, this has been an ongoing story. Right after World War II, people were horrified by the role of physicians and nurses in the treatment of POWs in Germany and Japan. And so this standard of docs emerged right after that and evolved through the World Medical Association, culminating in the Declaration of Tokyo. And it's progressively gotten more stringent because of the fact that around 60% of torture victims report seeing a health professional involved in monitoring their interrogation, setting up how harsh the interrogation can be, and so forth. And these standards are well known. Now, what's so interesting about the Defense Department analysis and the Department of Justice analysis of how to proceed with the abuse of prisoners is they don't make a single reference to any of this literature. In fact, they treat the medical personnel just like any other soldier, whereas medical personnel who are taking care of prisoners of war have a primary and exclusive obligation just to the health of the prisoners.
They're, in essence, functioning almost like a lawyer would be in representing a soldier who is or a prisoner who's charged with crime, that they have a particular direct responsibility to their patients.
Well, I think that's right. The other thing is that the U.S. government, the British government, the Israeli government, and presumably the East Bloc countries as well, have all done extensive research on coercive interrogation, and it doesn't work. It gets bad information. One military intelligence guy I was talking to in Iraq said what we were doing was we were sending our soldiers out on these dangerous sorties because they were chasing wild goose chases from information we obtained by torture. And in the most egregious example, the bioweapons collaboration between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda was information that came from a prisoner that we transported to Egypt and then tortured. He gave that information. That became a key part of the rationale for the entire war on terror.
We're talking to Dr. Stephen Miles. We'll come back to him after break.
It was back in 1942. I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging. We'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist-deep in the big muddy. The big fool says to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, Pete Seeger, here on Democracy Now! And Pete Seeger will be our featured guest on Monday, on July 3rd, for a Democracy Now! Special. On Tuesday, we hope you tune in as well. We'll be speaking with radio pioneer Dave Isay. Dave Isay, who is the founder of StoryCorps, which promises to be one of the largest oral history projects this country has ever seen, and we'll be playing excerpts of conversations between loved ones recorded throughout this country. We're talking now, though, about torture. The book Oath, Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and War on Terror is written by Stephen Miles, our guest. I wanted to ask you about the debate that's going on now in the psychiatric and psychological community. Both the American Psychiatric Association and the American Medical Association have adopted policies discouraging their members from being involved in military interrogations. But their counterpart, the American Psychological Association, far larger than the American Psychiatric Association, has not adopted such a policy. Earlier this month, we had a discussion on Democracy Now! On the role of psychiatrists and psychologists in military interrogations. We talked to the president of the American Psychological Association, Dr. Gerald Kuchar. This is an excerpt of what he had to say.
Obviously, there are some people who don't think that psychologists should assist in the military at all. That's a political preference and a social statement. But there are many very beneficial things that psychologists have done in the military. One example is that the lead officer sent in to help clean up Guantanamo Bay was a psychologist, a U.S. Army colonel, who was sent in to help clean up the abuses as soon as they were reported. There's another APA member, a civilian employee of the Navy, who was sent to Guantanamo and was one of the first people to file complaints with his superiors about things that he observed down there, and he reportedly brought about some changes. I wish I had the assurance that Jane Mayer and that Dr. Reisner apparently have that there are APA members doing bad things at Guantanamo or elsewhere, because any time I have asked these journalists or other people who are making these assertions for names so that APA could investigate its members who might be allegedly involved in them, no names have ever been forthcoming.
Dr. Gerald Kuchar, president of the American Psychological Association, a few weeks ago on Democracy Now!. The New York Times wrote a piece a few weeks ago saying that the military is turning away from psychiatrists because of their policy, that they should not be involved with interrogations, and is now relying on psychologists. You heard what Dr. Gerald Kuchar had to say. There's a growing movement within the American Psychological Association for psychologists to withhold dues from the American Psychological Association, to withdraw from the APA, and the question of whether there will be a resolution put forward that says no involvement in interrogation. What is your response to Kuchar and that?
Well, I think that it's interesting that Kuchar talks about the psychologists who did resist the abuses and then says that the ones who participated have to be APA members or something like that. But there actually is a well-known name, a psychologist by the name of Lesso. And Lesso participated in the interrogation of a guy called Katami. Katami was subjected to an incredibly brutal and extended interrogation, which included such stupid things as running 3 liters of saline into his body, and then when he needed to urinate, keeping him strapped to a table so he had to pee on himself. And then also he was chilled with an air conditioner to the point where his heart actually slowed down. He was hospitalized, and then he was brought out to the be interrogated some more after he was rewarmed, and then he was chilled again and his heart again slowed down. In addition to that, there was a whole set of degrading psychological techniques applied to him, and it appears that Lesso was directly involved in the oversight of that. The complete interrogation log is available on the Time website. So the problem overall problem, though, is that American medicine was entirely caught off guard by the American military involvement in brutal treatment. This does represent a break in terms of our treatment of POWs compared to World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and Gulf War I. And the AMA and the American Psychiatric Association have come out with very good standards, but the problem is they waited 4 years to do so. The APA came out about a year after the Abu Ghraib pictures, constituting a committee where the clean voting block, by about two-thirds voting block, was people with former military experience. And there was a groupthink within this process, which essentially wound up creating an accommodation between psychologists and a course of interrogation. They said that the Geneva Conventions had to apply, but they allowed psychologists to conceal their identity. They allowed psychologists to work with interrogations so long as they were safe and legal in order to make them effective. Well, this government's definition of what's a legal interrogation is infinitely elastic. And so that this is not a profound barrier to psychologists. And it doesn't surprise me that the military will shift over to working with psychologists. In fact, they screen the docs before they go down to Guantanamo to make sure they have no moral objections to force feeding. And then they take the docs who don't have an objection to force feeding, and those are the docs who get to go to Guantanamo.
Explain force feeding.
Well, hunger striking is a form of a political protest by prisoners. It's against medical ethics for prison physicians to force feed prisoners, because what it's felt that it does is that by keeping a prisoner alive, it basically extends the abuse of the prisoner. Okay? And that's exactly what's happening in Guantanamo. These prisoners have no rights, they have no correspondence, and anything like that. And so by feeding them, all that's being done is their indeterminate sentences, their lack of correspondence, and the other types of interrogational abuse are being extended. And so the military's tying them into six-point chairs, legs, thorax, abdomen, and arms, and then sticking a tube down them, running a bunch of food in, pulling the tube out. And because docs object to this professionally, they're selecting a subset of docs to take down to Guantanamo to do this procedure.
I'd like to get back to your comment where you said that you thought that what was happening in the war on terror was a break with past practices of the U.S. military. How big is that break, really? Because obviously there have been instances where states with which our allies of the United States were participating in terror. And there are questions clearly about how the U.S. military acted in Vietnam with the Phoenix program and
right.
Other programs where there were documented cases of torture of captured Viet Cong.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize I'm talking here about the military medical system and its treatment of POWs. Mm-hmm. The subset of issues of the U.S. support for client states that engage in torture, as happened commonly throughout South America, for example, is one thing. The Phoenix program was actually operated in coordination with the government of South Vietnam, in which we supplied lists of people to be captured, interrogated, and killed by the South Vietnamese. But with regard to the actual operation, the medical treatment of POWs, we really, I think, have set the standard up until now.
And in your book, you often refer to what happened during World War II, in Nazi Germany, and many Americans who are not that familiar with our practices there would say that you're stretching the analogy to begin to compare what we're doing here as a country that is involved in torture with what happened in Nazi Germany.
Well, I think that's a fair criticism, and the only point that I make about World War II is that's where the standards came from. And I think there's a big difference between what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo, with Nazi medicine, because in Nazi medicine, what the docs did was they created this theory of race hygiene and eugenics, which justified this wholesale genocide policy. Similarly, in the Soviet Union, they developed this, the physicians developed this concept of sluggish schizophrenia, which resulted in the imprisonment for treatment of dissidents. What this looks like is much more like the experience in South American prisons, where the physicians come in and essentially certify that you're going to be able to take this kind of abuse, and then going ahead and monitoring it. And then in the case of several of the South American countries, there were physicians who wrote false death certificates, some of which were actually disbarred after the Reign of Terror in various countries, and at least one of whom was assassinated by after the Reign of Terror.
The Los Angeles Times says the real blockbuster in the Hamdan decision is the court's holding that Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention applies to the conflict with al-Qaeda, a holding that makes high-ranking Bush administration officials potentially subject to prosecution under the Federal War Crimes Act. You talked about this holding the highest-level officials accountable.
Right. The U.S. War Crimes Act is a fascinating law. It's very short. Go look it up on the web, anybody who's listening. What it says is this: not only have we endorsed Geneva as a treaty, okay, but in addition, we made it a federal crime for a U.S. government employee to violate Geneva. And so it's not just a violation of international law, it's a violation of federal law. Now, what the Bush administration has been arguing is that the president's discretionary war-making powers allow him to set aside any law besides our treaty obligations, which is an incredibly dangerous thing. What this does is set the stage for domestic prosecution of U.S. officials for violating the War Crimes Act, but also in a really interesting case that was brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights against Rumsfeld in Germany. The German prosecutor declined to subpoena or indict Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld because it had not yet been shown that the U.S. courts would fail to do so. With this Supreme Court ruling, I think that the ground is cleared for asking whether or not U.S. Judicial system will rise to its responsibility and enforce the Geneva Accords.
You talk in your book that as you were reading these 35,000 pages of documents on the various mistreatment and torture of prisoners, that you yourself became transformed as you delved into these stories. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, when I first saw these pictures from Abu Ghraib, the question was, well, where were the docs? Because docs and nurses are frontline human rights monitors. They're there when the Red Cross isn't. They can get into any part of the prison. And furthermore, even if they don't see the abuse, they see the signs of the abuse. And we are trained to find abuse when it's crafted to be indiscernible, okay, as a lot of abuse is. And so I'm reading along, I'm just trying to understand why there was a failure of reporting. And all of a sudden, what I'm seeing is that the medical system is entirely integrated into the abuse. That there was a structure, there was an actual policy mechanism that can be seen for the delayed release of torture-related homicides. That there was an entire structure for culling patients' medical records for information on their vulnerabilities, incorporating that into harsh and coercive interrogation plans, monitoring those plans, and designing those plans with psychological insights to exploit the particular characteristics of Islamic men, and then monitoring the disintegration of these men and feeding that back into the torture plans. It's an amazing story. It was very discouraging to read. But in every country that's fought torture, and Chile's a good example, the docs have played a key role in stopping it.
Dr. Stephen Miles, I want to thank you very much for being with us. His book is Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror. And that does it for today's program. Tonight, I'll be up at Stone Ridge at Quimby Auditorium at SUNY Ulster with the head of WAMC, Alan Shartok, and Jeff Cohen and Danny Schechter. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, who helped co-produce John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.